Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. What a nice big crowd. So last week, Rayon talked about spiritual transformation is the transformation of the body. And today, I want to talk about one particular physical practice that we do here that transforms the body, and that's bowing, which we just did. 9 times 2. It's one of the first forms you encounter when you come here as a new person. Full prostration bows. And maybe when you first saw it, you didn't really know what to make of it. It's a very un-Western kind of thing, this room full of people putting themselves down on the floor together. If you're like most of us, you either loved it or you hated it. Most people don't have a neutral response to bowing. Now, in all of its forms, there are many, many forms. Very old practice. It's found throughout all of Buddhism, and it's found in most religions. One form or another of putting ourselves down or below something. And it's said that it was given to Shakyamuni in the very distant past, in past lives, by the 7 Buddhas. But it's certainly been present ever since Buddhism was formed. But by the time Shinryo Suzuki came to the West, became a priest and came to the West, it was typical in the Soto Zen monasteries to bow 3 times during ceremonies. And when he came to the United States, he instituted this practice. So this was quite a long time ago. Buddhism was very new to the United States. People had a lot of notions about it, but not a lot of experience. And one of the first things he did with this sort of motley group of lay people was institute 3 full prostration bows during services, before and after service. And immediately people had really negative reactions. They would say it's not appropriate for Americans, it's too Japanese, it's too foreign. So, and this kept going, so he changed 3 bows to 9 bows. And said, here in America, we are so stubborn. It is better to do 9 bows. And then he told people they would learn the importance of bowing by bowing. There was no other way to learn it. And later in an interview, he said, I know people will be discouraged. I know we are causing a lot of discouragement for American people when we bow 9 times. They only bow 3 times in Japan. So I bow 9 times here in America. And it was a way of saying you only learn about this discouragement through being discouraged as well. You have to confront it. So we bow 9 times. Now there are a lot of forms of bowing, even within Zen, even within Soto. We take our form of bowing from Dogen. He gives very detailed instructions, as is his way, for bowing in a particular fascicle called Dharani, and I'm going to come back to that. He describes in this chapter when and how to do 1 bow, 3 bows, 6 bows, 9 bows, or 12 bows for different circumstances. Here, generally, we bow 3 times or 9 times. And I was thinking, what's the most bows I've ever done in a day? And it would have been on a New Year's, and it was about 140 bows in a day. I'm not very tough. So there's nothing special about that at all. In Kwannon Zen, which is a form of Korean Buddhism, they do 108 bows every single morning. Often as fast as they can do it. If you've ever seen this practice, it's kind of amazing. And Dogen also acknowledges the practice of 100,000 bows, which is a, pretty common vow that people take in Vajrayana or Tibetan Buddhism to do 100,000 vows in your lifetime, which is an intense practice. A few people will take a vow to do 1,000,000 vows in their lifetime, which if you sit down and figure out how much time that takes, it's pretty much your job to be bowing. And some people have taken that on as their lifelong practice, simply to bow. So how does Dogen tell us to bow? I was trying to do it this morning. It's really tricky. The bow is the whole motion from start to finish. So we tend to think that we're bowing when we're on the ground, but you're bowing from the very start, from standing up, making a show, bending, kneeling, prostrating, raising the hands, and gradually standing up again. And the center of the bow is called Gotai Tochi, which means five parts of the body cast to the ground. Those five parts are the knees, the elbows, and the forehead. So technically, the hands don't touch, which if you don't have a really strong core, it's pretty tricky. Dogen says it's one at a time. So it's like knee, knee, elbow, elbow, forehead, and the hands are kept palm up by the ears and don't touch the ground. And when you're in all five parts, you raise the hands. And these open palms are accepting the feet of the Buddha and raising the Buddha above you for a moment. Then you got to get up without putting the hands down, which is very tricky. Oh, Nini. So Miyazumi, who was another one of the early Japanese teachers here, he gave lots of instruction about bowing. And he said, of course, you want to move really smoothly and gracefully in this whole motion from standing all the way down and up to standing, one sort of smooth, graceful motion. But also not to bow too quickly, he said, as though trying to get it over with, and not to bow too slowly. He said, if our bow is too slow, it becomes a rather pompous display. We may have gotten too attached to the feeling of bowing or our own real or imagined gracefulness of movement. Imagined gracefulness of movement. So I tell you all that because I want to make it clear that's an idealized, stereotyped bow. It's not an ideal bow. It's the stereotyped posture of bowing. But an ideal bow is something altogether. That posture I just described is a skeleton for the ideal bow. So changing gears a bit. In practice, we encounter three particular kinds of memory. One is what is called declarative memory. That's remembering an event, learning a fact, information, knowledge, that kind of thing. And we use that a lot here. You're gaining information and knowledge all the time here. There's another kind of memory which is called non-declarative because you can't describe it, and that includes body memory, physical memory, how to walk, how to tie your shoes, how to hold a fork, how to bow, how to shoot a free throw. There's a lot of different body memories, and we work with that all the time here in ritual movements. We learn how to meet our seats, how to walk in kinhin, how to open orioki bowls, and these gradually seep into our muscles. So between these two types of memory, the mind is informing the body is also informing the mind. One of the things we encounter is stillness in activity, but also activity within stillness, and how those two things can coexist. For a long time, it seems like we have to be still to experience stillness. But eventually you learn that you can contain stillness while moving. Now there's a third kind of memory, which is a little esoteric. It's like body, mind, memory. And Dogen's phrase for this is shin no kekafuza, sitting of body and sitting of mind. And then he says shin jin datsuraku no kekafuza, which is sitting of body and mind falling away. And Zazen contains all three of these kinds of memory, right? They're all activated when we sit. We know how to sit. We can describe how to sit. Our body experiences that stillness, and our wholeness comes to it and eventually can fall away within it. So this is how we begin to learn subconscious reactivity. The body and mind, my body and mind learned anxiety over a long time, and it unlearned anxiety. Body and mind both unlearned anxiety over time. We learn about excitement and resentment and fear. How is it in the body? How is it in the mind? How do we take those things apart and see that what we call fear, for instance, is physical sensations and thoughts that get coupled together and made into something bigger? If you can uncouple them, each part of it is not so big. So we learn how emotion feels in the body. We learn the thoughts that accompany particular sensations. We learn how all of this gets triggered. But we unlearn slowly. One of the most important things we do here is repetition. Repetition of everything. And this falling away, shinjin datsuraku, it can happen in a single moment of sitting and a moment of bowing. It's a moment of being nowhere else, being no thing in particular, no self in particular, but simply being bowing, being sitting. One of the questions people often ask about bowing is, to whom are we bowing? What's this all about? It looks like worship to a lot of people, and this is not what they came here for, and what's going on? Are we worshiping the Buddha? I've heard that question many times. Now, after his awakening under the Bodhi tree, Shakyamuni approached the five ascetics with whom he'd gone into the forest. And they really had wanted to turn away from him when he took food and sort of set out on the middle way. They rejected him. But when they saw him emerge from the forest, they were stunned by his radiance and his joy, and they spontaneously make full prostrations to the ground. But they weren't bowing to their friend Shakyamuni, or Gotama as he was known. They weren't bowing to their friend. They were bowing to this enlightened one, this Buddha that stepped out of Gotama, that stepped forward. And one of the first things the Buddha had said when he did experience his awakening was, we all share a perfect enlightened nature. So they were also Buddha bowing. So we always say that bowing is Buddha bowing to Buddha, Buddha recognizing Buddha. And because we're always Buddha bowing to Buddha, it doesn't matter what posture you take. I have a hip issue these days, and I find it problematic to do full bows sometimes. And sometimes I get down, but I have a little trouble getting up, so I just stay down there. Sometimes I bow from the waist, sometimes on my knees, sometimes I can do full bows. Doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. But as with group forms, we kind of want to always be moving at the speed of the group. So if you do bow too slowly, you might have to modify the posture to stay with the group. We have chairs here for a reason, and it really doesn't matter if you do full bows or standing bows or sitting bows. That's just framework. If you can do full bows, you might try doing a 5-point bow and see what it's like, because it's different. In all forms of bow, We put our hands by our ears and we raise the Buddha above us. And that's the Buddha bowing to the Buddha. So, doesn't matter how you do it, but if you're like me or like a lot of people, after a while you get kind of attached to it. And senior students and teachers, maybe most of all, can get very attached to doing forms in a particular way. And I've heard a lot of people mourn the changes their aging body was going through that was affecting how they sit, what, you know, whether they can sit cross-legged or not, and whether they can do bows or how quickly they can do fast kinhin and so on. As though those things were the practice. We can get very confused about that, or that they had anything to do with understanding. So most of us will experience some kind of clinging to form at some point. Sometimes we are clinging to any form of external support. And the ritual forms in the Zendo feel so protective and supportive. Fine. Sometimes we go through a honeymoon, or we're just in a really passionate period in our practice, and we love the forms and we seek the forms. Excuse me. Sometimes this clinging to the bow is a form of withdrawal or self-abnegation. It's misunderstanding what it means to put yourself to the ground. And it can be pompous. It can be show-offy. It can be rigid. It can be all those things. I've also encountered a few instances where people refuse to bow. Either they refuse to bow to a particular person, or during a particular ceremony, or even to a particular ancestor or lineage. And I'm so struck. I just remember being so struck by the idea that you would refuse to bow to anyone. I think we should never look for a reason not to bow. We are in the business of recognizing the Buddha in each other, in everything, in every being. Bring someone to mind that you would not want to bow to, and bow to them, at least in your mind. Now, this has been, bowing has been for me partly a practice of letting go of aggression. And in particular, this kind of subtle aggression, which is self-assertion. Assertion of my desire, assertion of my intention, my expectation, vanity about how I appear, wanting to be seen in the world. You know, this is the aggression of insisting on your own agenda, on your own central role. And bowing should be a moment of letting go of any opinions, any demands, opening to all beings, opening to all time, all moments. So just as, you know, there's this saying, Zazen doesn't care. It doesn't care what you think about it. It's just there. You can take it or leave it. And bowing doesn't care either. Bowing is just kind of waiting for me to show up. One thing I've learned is that you meet the bow best by immediately turning toward it. So in my ideal bow, the bell rings and I have an immediate response, an immediate willingness to get up, whether I'm distracted, whether I'm sleepy, whether I'm in pain, but a willingness to meet that call, to hear that bell as a call to do this Buddha, bowing to Buddha. And I know that it's really deeply stored in my tissues, this response to the bell. How many times have you done this because you heard a bell? But for all that, for decades of bowing and this deep sense of response in my body, I've never done a perfect bow. Bowing is perfect, but the actual bow is never perfected. It's one reason I love Orioki is that I've never done it perfectly. Even when I've gotten close, there's always something that can be just a little bit more perfect. And bowing's like that too. It can always be just a little bit more total. Maybe the only thing missing is there's a little part of my mind that isn't there. Some little part of me that isn't wholly present. So every repetition is another opportunity to bring total attention, total care with how the task is done, to meet each bow as unique, a completely new bow, not like any other bow you've ever done. The bow's just there waiting. And, you know, we made all these forms up. Is this all imaginary? It's not some sacred thing that was handed down on tablets. It's a mirror. Every form is a mirror. There's no magic in the forms except the magic of how it mirrors you. So when you bow, notice what you see in that mirror. When you hear that bell, what do you see? Hear. What response? Now, another thing Suzuki said is sometimes we bow to dogs and cats. Sometimes the teacher bows to the student. You should be prepared to bow even in your last moment. I love that. Even in your last moment. What better way to meet the last moment than this full round bow? Bowing is an act of generosity. It is really dropping the self. It's dropping that self-assertion. It's giving to the world. Robert Aitken called bowing the perfection of relinquishment. So in the bow, we're letting everything go. We're giving everything up for just that one moment. The universe is incredibly full and rich, and we have so much, such plenty. Generosity comes from gratitude. The bow can really show us, for this moment, I have whatever I need. I have everything I need right here, and I'm fully present right here. That opens our heart. It's never an act of shame or self-abnegation. If you notice shame in your bow, if you notice self-criticism in your bow, please turn toward that, investigate that. A bow is an act of humility, not shame. The body folds up and surrenders its power. And I'm struck by the fact that no animal does this except in submission. Nothing takes that posture except in submission. The bow teaches us to relax into this true human vulnerability. We hide the face for a moment. We're hiding that clamoring ego self for a moment, all the way down. But it's not beneath like an inferior creature. It's beneath, I think of it as like grass or soil. Solid, still, stable. We have a true self inside that is awakening all the time. The heart beats because it's a heart, right? That's the nature of a heart, it beats. And the nature of our true self is awakening, not a learned behavior. You can learn stillness, you can learn calmness, you can learn all kinds of stability, but you can't learn awakening. It's already there. This kind of ceaseless, endless practice realization. So, to end, I want to come back to Dogen and his instructions. He does these instructions in a chapter called Dharani. Dharani are magical formulas and incantations and spells of all kinds. And we use Dharani sometimes to invoke particular states. Throughout this chapter, he barely addresses this idea. Almost the entire chapter is devoted to bowing. And then at the last part of the chapter, he talks a little bit about putting on your robes. And he does come around to magic at the end, but he's talking about bowing. And so I'll end with his quote. All who have come and taken refuge in the true Dharma have naturally paid obeisance. By their reciting this spell, all the whole earth has been pacified and protected. The realms in all directions have been pacified and formed. The realms in all times have been pacified and manifested. All the Buddha realms have been pacified and created. It is from this Dharani gate that all the Buddhas and ancestors invariably bring forth the mind of Bodhi, pursue the way, attain the way, and turn the wheel of Dharma. All that in a bow.
If you're in the room, please raise your hand and I will bring the microphone to you. And please speak your name before you offer your question and your comments. If you're on Zoom, please type your name and Kay will unmute you. Or you can type your question and Kay will speak out your questions.
Zheng Kong, I like this idea of respect for everything. Respect for myself, even for a blank wall. And I will actually bow to a blank wall. There may not be anything there, but it's that kind of like giving respect to the universe. And it makes me feel good inside, and it's just a flow, and I really enjoy it, and I respect everybody. I bow to you all. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Mikio. I really wish I had heard your talk today 50 years ago when I was in Japan. When I came to the United States about 40 years ago, I was so glad that people are not bowing. Because people are not bowing to each other in the United States. And it was so relaxing. Because in Japan, I always felt like, what is that? Inappropriate or something that, you know, the way people bow and how much you bow or when you bow and all those things are too complicated for me. And I always felt inappropriate. So I was so glad in the United States people are not doing it. And but then I don't really mind doing this, you know, nine bows like this. And I think it's much more complicated because if you have somebody in front of you and you have to kind of judge when and how you do it. And I just remembered that how hard it was for me. Thank you.
You know, Dogen also talks about, and there are also instructions for making gassho and doing half bows. And in the monastic rules, there are some real nuances about who bows first and how deep you go down. It's the same thing. And it can definitely get a little silly. It can get self-centered. But at the same time, I think it's really useful to experience someone bowing to you and noticing what happens for yourself when someone bows to you, especially a full prostration bow in front of you can really trigger things. So it's all good. Being on any side of it is good.
Hello, my name is Julia. You mentioned there being stillness and movement, and I was wondering if you could say more about that, and where is the stillness if you're moving?
Where is the stillness and movement?
Yeah.
Right here. Right here. I think you, it's very hard to describe it. I think you have to experience it and look for it when the bell rings for Kinhin and you stand up, because that's what Kinhin is for. It's one of our clearest lessons of, can you maintain the stillness of mind in Zazen while your body is moving? And one way you learn that is, you know, Kinhin is very particular, half breath per step. You know, you just move very slowly. You only take a half step at a time. And that takes a lot of concentration. I've walked so carefully in Kinhin, I've almost fallen down. I mean, you have to really concentrate. And then eventually that concentration falls away and you are just walking. That's stillness and activity, just walking. You know it. You do it probably all the time. You touch this all the time. Walking through a park and you're looking at a tree or you're listening to a bird and you're just hearing the bird. There's nothing added to it.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Ruby. To honor someone, is it like a myriad of things to like honor someone's wisdom or state of mind? Is it to like honor someone's the collective consciousness? Like, I have so many questions. Like, is it just honor one person? Well, no, you said it wasn't, but like, is it like the enlightened state of mind or to like be grateful? I'm not really sure.
There are all kinds of reasons, from very superficial to very deep reasons, that we try to find respect for and honor for other people. And it's particularly important to notice the ones that we're turning away from. And you can completely reject a person's behavior. You can try to stop somebody's behavior from harming another person and not reject the person. I'm not saying I know how to do this all the time, or that it's particularly easy, or that I never feel aversion or hatred. I do. But I need to work on that. I need to find that perfect self inside. There is a part of everyone, every being, everything that touches this universal self. Even if that's the only part I can honor, I've got to look for that.
Okay, I think I understand what you're saying, because like, it's a form of respect. I remember, this is off topic, but I remember I was like really annoyed and I was in this like super hot bar. And I was like, I hate everyone here. And there was this girl like just like bothering me, and I was just like, oh, I wish she would leave. And she was like, I'm so hot. And I'm like, oh, I'm really hot. And then I found like a self of respect, and I was like, I'm not sure if that's honoring someone.
Well, it's finding a way, it's identifying with somebody. So there is honor there. There's respect there. You're finding a place that you meet.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Eric. When you brought up the possibility of bowing to someone we really don't want to bow to, I mean, as you're just talking about, there's something in everybody. My mind immediately went to this person I had a harmful relationship with nearly two decades ago. And the fact that my mind went immediately to him just indicates how, you know, he's still kind of present in there somewhere. And the thing is, and I mean this not as a joke, I think he might be a sociopath. And I guess that makes it hard for me to identify where his Buddha nature might be. And so I don't know if you have, like, there are people who I don't like and who I'm angry at, and I can find their goodness more, you know, readily enough. But this one individual, I don't know how to locate that. I don't know if there's been writings on how to do this for sociopaths. I don't know.
Well, so that might be a bridge too far to start with. So you might start a little with something a little bit easier. But people who are really damaged, who are kind of deformed by karma, who have real twisted personalities or mental conditions, try to notice how much suffering there is there. That suffering created that, and there's suffering within it. And if nothing else, you can at least recognize there's pain there. Even if it's subconscious, unconscious pain. People who are really damaged need to be bowed to. They need to be recognized. But don't give yourself an assignment that's impossible. You know, start somewhere closer.
Thank you.
Oh, let's see.
Hi, I'm Benny. Thank you for your talk. I think for me, bowing is like the ultimate form of compassion. Whenever I've dealt with a lot, often in my practice recently, when I've met with challenging conditions, I find myself bowing. And it's kind of like I find myself bowing to myself, just like, oh yeah, this is the moment, just to bow. And that has been kind of very formative for my practice to just know that this is kind of the form that I take. This is the bow that I take, and always to see myself and to bow to myself. That has been like very expansive. So thank you.
And that's a really wise intuition there, that sometimes we need this so much for ourselves. We're not just bowing to others. We are also a being in the world that needs to be cared for. And sometimes we're bowing for that. Bowing can be a practice of acceptance, even of difficult circumstances. That's a good time to bow, is when things are really rough. So you just have sort of intuitively happened upon them.
Thank you.
Time for one or two more.
Hey, Chico, this is Zonio. Can you teach me anything about being more gracious when bowing isn't happening? When you are, let's say you're Shuso, and how can you meet like resistance with compassion?
Say a little more when bowing isn't happening, when people are not bowing in response to...
Sure, yeah.
to your direction as Shuso.
Or in any form that we take.
Yeah. Whenever there's resistance bow some more. I think you do the bowing then. You know, it really is that bow of acceptance. Sometimes these conditions are just not good. I'm still here. I'm still present. Depending on the role, you might need to remind people.
Thank you.
But, yeah. We got one more over here, Genko, over there. And then we'll call it.
Hi, thank you for your talk. This is Genko. I think of bowing to life. You know, we just had a something about bowing to the universe. I think about every being who has life has courage, because otherwise you can't be living. There's something about getting up every day and moving forward with your life that requires some measure of courage and decision. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. And if I can find nothing else to bow to and respect, it is that. And we all have that. It's Buddha nature, I suppose you could say as well.
No, I think that's really wise. And I think it's really easy for us to forget that other people, that person in front of us at the mini mart and that person at the traffic light, have as rich and full and complex lives as we do. It's really easy to make other people be more objects in the world than full, whole beings. And the Tao should remind us, every life is so complicated. Every life is so important.
And precious.
And precious, yeah.